Welcome to The Mental Breakdown, where we tackle all issues related to mental health, mental illness, parenting, schooling, relationships, and everything in between. While Drs. Bernie and Richard will provide the most up-to-date ideas and perspectives, the information provided in this podcast is not a substitute for medical care. Our goal here at The Mental Breakdown is to provide you with information to help you make your life the best it can be. So without further ado, here's Dr. Bernie and Dr. Richard. Welcome to episode 20 of The Mental Breakdown. I'm Dr. Bernie.
And I'm Dr. Richard.
And Richard, it is that time of year.
Start of a new school year. Some schools went back this week.
Yes.
But the public schools start next week, right?
Yeah, yes. They're about a week and a half away.
Week and a half, right.
They start back in this area on the 24th. Right. But certainly some of the private schools have already started. Other private schools and charter schools start next week. And then the remainder of the schools get started on the 24th.
And the start of a school year is exciting, but also anxiety-producing.
It is very anxiety-producing.
And that's our topic for today, isn't it?
It is. We're gonna continue our conversation from last week. Well, we took a week off, actually. We didn't get to do a podcast last week. All kinds of things going on and trips that had to be made that were unexpected that led to us going to different places. But we're back here recording this week and I like recording. I like doing these podcasts and talking to people and anonymous people that we don't get to see.
Right.
Talk to them about some of these things and hopefully helping some people out. You know, something I want to mention before we get started is last week we had our first workshop.
Oh, that's right.
Last week on ADHD, mm-hmm. and it went very well. The people that attended the workshop gave us some very nice reviews and says some very nice things about it. And I think that it went well because we got to talk to some parents and teachers about ADHD and its effects on not only the child, but the parents and the teachers. And so I think it went very well. We have another workshop that's going to be coming up next month on September 18th. That's going to be a Friday morning, and we're going to be talking about the same topic that we're talking about today, anxiety. Mm-hmm. It's going to be very exciting and hopefully informative and helpful for people because, as you said, anxiety is something that is really a problem this time of year, not just for students but for parents as well. And so we're going to be talking a lot about anxiety over the next few weeks and whether we're doing it on podcast, in workshops, or with patients.
Right, right.
We'll be talking about it a lot.
Right. And with that, the reminder that we are going to be scheduling workshops on a more regular basis.
That's right. That's okay. Another exciting thing coming up.
Go to our websites.
Yep.
Twitter, iTunes,
websites. It'll be everywhere. Yeah.
Right. And take a look at those because we're going to be doing them monthly.
Right.
On a variety of topics. So stay tuned for those. And hope to see you there as well.
Yeah, we're going to, I guess there's a lot of new things going on. We were sitting here before we clicked the record button, trying to figure out how we were going to start out this podcast. And neither of us could come up with what we needed to announce until we clicked record. And so, yes, we're going to actually be starting a newsletter, mm-hmm. a monthly newsletter. Through our practice. And in that newsletter, we're going to talk about just some new things that are going on and some hot topics, but also we'll have a calendar of events that's going to announce the upcoming workshops. And as Richard said, we are planning workshops every month through the year.
Right.
And so we'll be announcing those soon. We'll have a schedule of events coming out, and it'll be not only on our website at PACFlorida, PACFlorida.com, but also on our blog at TheMentalBreakdown.com, and we'll have it on Facebook and Twitter and everywhere else that we try to have a face.
And don't forget that special event in October.
Yes, that's an exciting thing as well. We're going to have an open house here at our office. We're going to be inviting anyone that would like to come, kind of see what we're doing, see the office. We can talk. We're putting faces to names and names to faces, and trying to get the word out about what we do here, the different services that we have available, some of the new faces that we have here in the practice, and exciting times.
Good times, right.
So we have all kinds of things coming out. So keep an eye out on our Facebook page, Facebook/The Mental Breakdown, and our website at pacflorida.com, because we'll be having the first newsletter will be coming out soon. And I'll have lots of great information about upcoming events. So stay tuned.
Right.
With all that being said, let's get into our topic for the day. And as I said, we're going to continue our conversation from last time, which was about normal anxieties. The anxieties that we typically experience at different developmental stages, whether it's stranger anxiety when we're small and toddlers, separation anxiety as we start approaching through toddlerhood and into early school age, performance anxiety as we get older, and so on. There are normal anxieties that we feel at different stages of development, and there's things that parents can do to help address those.
Right. Yeah. This is a treatable disorder, and it's sad because only about 35% of the people who have anxiety disorder are treated.
Right.
And yet this is one of the most treatable disorders that we encounter.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
We encourage you that if this becomes if anxiety is an issue in your family, to seek treatment, because the treatments that are available are successful.
So let's talk about what we mean by anxiety disorder. So we have these typical anxieties that we are referring to as anxieties. We have those typical ones at different stages of development. But, you know, Richard, I know that I do, and I'm sure that you do as well. We have patients that come in and they will endorse anxiety. We say, you know, are there ever times when you experience anxiety or stress or worry? And they say yes. And I think it's important that we differentiate anxiety from stress. Right. Those are two different things, right?
They are. Yeah, it becomes a complicated topic from the beginning, because we want to make sure that anxiety is a normal, we talked about that in the last podcast, that having anxiety is a normal human reaction.
Right.
In fact, our brain is supposed to feel anxiety.
Right.
Because it has a purpose it plays a role in our life. But we're going to talk about that in a second, right?
Right, right. Now, so when we're thinking about anxiety and we're differentiating that from stress, stress is what we need. We need to experience stress. We need to experience that discomfort that motivates us to do something.
Right. Stress is motivating.
Right.
It motivates us to do things.
Right. So when you have a deadline, mm-hmm. You experience some stress associated with that deadline, and that pushes you to meet that deadline.
Mm-hmm.
That's different than anxiety. Anxiety, what we're going to talk about is anxiety and anxiety disorders. That's different. And so I want to first make sure that we articulate that well, that we're not, what we're going to be talking about today isn't typical stress, because we do all experience stress and we need to experience stress.
Mm-hmm.
Remember last week, you used some fancy words with it, but I called it the inverted U.
Oh.
And you called it a Yorkie Dachshund.
Close. Yorkie's a dog.
Oh, that's right.
Yorkies.
So, but what we're referring to is that stress, different levels of stress are needed to perform at your optimal level.
Right.
If you have zero stress, it basically means that you don't care.
Mm-hmm.
So zero stress leads to, in essence, zero performance. But as stress increases, your performance increases until you get to a certain stage to where the stress is overbearing and starts to impair your ability to function well. So stress is necessary. Stress is something that we have to experience if we want to be successful, if we want to do well, if we want to meet deadlines. Where we're getting into today is talking about anxiety. And anxiety is different, because anxiety leads to fear.
Right.
So even if you're experiencing stress, if that stress begins to turn into fear, dread, panic, then that's when we're starting to get into the potential of some type of disorder.
And that's the crucial, I think the crucial connection here is that anxiety is related to fear.
Right.
And it's important to differentiate anxiety, fear, and stress.
Right.
Okay. So when you think of anxiety, think of fear.
Right.
Because that's what we're dealing with.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. And so with that being said, let's talk a little bit about how our new diagnostic system has sort of divided our anxiety right. disorders. Mm-hmm. Historically, there was one category right. called anxiety disorders, right. and everything was sort of placed underneath that broad umbrella. Mm-hmm. But now, the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, has sort of divided them up into different categories. And these different categories begin to make sense if we think about what is happening with them. So let's talk a little bit about what those three classes are. The way that the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, divides them, we have anxiety disorders, we have stress-related disorders, and we have obsessive disorders. Mm-hmm. So it divides those three into distinct categories. The way that I like to think about them as it is not necessarily by those titles, but by what those disorders elicit or what causes those disorders to manifest.
Right.
So let's begin with the first one, anxiety. There are a lot of diagnoses under the broad category of anxiety, right? There, we have generalized anxiety disorder, we have various phobias, we have selective mutism.
Right. There are 11
diagnoses
that come under that general category of anxiety disorder.
Right. Mm-hmm. And what we're talking about and what differentiates these particular diagnoses from maybe some of the other diagnoses is that these diagnoses are all about anticipation.
Of something bad.
Of
happening.
Something bad happening.
Okay.
Right.
Right.
So when we get it, when we talk about and relate this to the fear that we were talking about a moment ago.
Right.
The problem is, or the anxiety is the anticipation of something bad happening. So the
right.
fear that something bad is going to happen.
Right.
And so when we think about it that way, what we have to recognize is that these disorders, like generalized anxiety disorder, like specific phobias, social phobia or social anxiety disorder, even selective mutism, all of these are disorders of anticipation,
right.
Of the concern of something bad happening.
Right, right.
So that differentiates them from other anxiety disorders. Other anxiety disorders like the second category of stress. And that's where we have things like post-traumatic stress disorder, adjustment disorders, and some other things in there. And those are disorders of panic. And we're going to get into what I mean by panic there here in just a few minutes. And then the third category, the obsessive category, those are more disorders associated with prevention. And now that seems like that seems almost counterintuitive or almost paradoxical. But these are disorders where we have developed a maladaptive way to prevent or cope with anxiety that then begin to impair functioning. So if we feel distressed about something, we engage in a particular set of behaviors to try to relieve that anxiety. And those behaviors are what starts to become impairing.
Okay, so I want to make sure I understand these. So the first, you have three categories.
Right.
First category is anxiety.
Right. Just general anxiety.
Which consists of these 11 types of anxiety.
Correct.
Okay.
Right.
So that's one. The second one are the panic disorders.
Right. And the way the DSM refers to them is stress. But yes, these are all disorders that tend to be associated with some form of panic.
Okay. And then the third category would be obsessive compulsive disorders.
Right.
And when you say preventive, you're saying that these are disorders, they're disorders because we're using our compulsive behaviors to prevent or to manage our obsessions.
Right. Our obsessive anxieties, our obsessive worries.
Okay.
Right. So
there's anxiety, panic, and obsession.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. And that again mirrors what the DSM now how the DSM now categorizes these things.
Right.
So when it comes to anxiety, let's just focus here for just a moment on anxiety. And anxiety is discomfort. It is a stress-related response to something. And what makes anxiety disorders in general, including all three categories, what makes anxiety disorders somewhat unique is that, by and large, all of the symptoms are the same. When we experience anxiety, whether it's because of a generalized anxiety disorder, or it's because of an obsessive disorder, or if it's because of a social phobia, social anxiety disorder, our response to those in our symptoms are all the same.
And you're talking about our physical reaction to those things, to those fears.
Right.
Okay.
They're all the same. So we experience trembling, we experience rapid heartbeat, we experience shakiness, nervousness, discomfort, sometimes nausea. All of those symptoms are the same. And so when a person comes into the office or a person is experiencing anxiety, when we talk to them about it, all of those symptoms are exactly the same.
Right.
What differentiates between the different diagnoses is the focal point of the fear.
What by focal point you mean? What triggers
the fear
the
response?
Fear response. Okay.
Right.
All right. All right.
So that makes anxiety disorders somewhat unique. And what that also leads to is an interesting phenomenon where we see anxiety disorders change over time. So I've had a patient, for example, who first came in with a disorder called agoraphobia.
Right.
He had a very unique presentation of it, but it was agoraphobia nonetheless. And agoraphobia is a disorder, basically a fear of open spaces, a fear of being in a situation where you can't get to help or get to safety or meet some need without serious embarrassment or other problems. So agoraphobia, people with agoraphobia tend to stay inside. They tend to avoid crowded public places. In our area, one of the key diagnostic features or key questions that you ask to rule out agoraphobia is the Disney World question.
Right.
Because a person with agoraphobia would never go to Disney. Mm-hmm. And even if they did, they would never ride Space Mountain. Because Space Mountain, just the line for Space Mountain is panic-inducing for the for the typical person, much less for the person with agoraphobia. So,
Florida's theme parks wouldn't be
a welcome
destination for people with agoraphobia.
Yeah, Walmart on Black Friday would be another example of, you know, Walmart is actually a great place for people with agoraphobia because they can go and do their grocery shopping at 2 o'clock in the morning when the store is empty.
I was going to say, go in the middle of the night.
Right. So the patient came in with agoraphobia, but then as time passed, we dealt with the agoraphobia. But then the triggers for his anxiousness began to shift. And then he became somewhat OCD, somewhat obsessive compulsive. And so he was having some obsessive thoughts that were troubling him. And he began to engage in behaviors to try to accommodate or to try to relieve those symptoms.
Right.
And then it turned into somewhat of a social anxiety because he began to focus on how other people saw him and other people were reacting to him and things that he did. So with anxiety disorders, unlike just about any other set of disorders that we have, the disorder itself can change over time. It can change from agoraphobia to OCD to social anxiety disorder to generalized anxiety disorder.
And you're saying the trigger,
right?
What triggers it can change, because I think this would be an appropriate place to say that once again, this is primarily a disorder of brain structures.
Right.
Okay, so there are underlying brain structures. And in the case of your patient, the brain remained the same.
Right.
It was going to be anxious. It was going to be fearful because that brain just works that way. That person's brain works that way. So you can take away one source of fear, but then another source will replace it because the brain is going to continue to react to something.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Good.
And so, and we're going to get into some brain stuff here in just a minute, because I think I think it's critical that people and patients and people struggling with anxiety understand that this is a brain-based condition. And
right.
Hopefully our listeners are recognizing that this is a common theme.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most true mental health issues
right.
are brain-based.
Right. And in the case of anxiety, the brain is doing what it's supposed to do.
Right.
I mean, these are normal. We don't want to make people think that it's... The brain is doing what it's supposed to do. We're supposed to be fearful at certain times. So the brain is structured to perceive fear and to perceive threats. What's happening in these cases is the threat isn't really real, or
right.
it's not likely. It might be real, but it's not likely going to occur.
Right.
And so... But the brain isn't doing anything that it's not built to do.
Right.
Okay.
And I think that that's a good point and a good place for us to bring in. This is, as you were saying, an evolutionary adaptation to our environment.
Right.
I mean, you know, if you, you know, imagine living in 1,000 years ago.
Right.
You know, 10,000 years ago. And you're walking or you're living last week. Right. In some areas of Africa or in some areas of South America, and you're mm-hmm. walking through the woods and you hear a rustling in mm-hmm. the shrubs. Well, you need to have an anxious right. response to that.
That's right.
Because that's what's going to keep you safe.
That's right.
Now, the likelihood is that it's the wind blowing and right. rustling the leaves. But there is a chance that it's a lion
right.
or a jaguar or a saber-toothed cat or, mm-hmm. or whatever.
Right.
And, well, not saber-toothed cats anymore because they're not around anymore. But about 10,000 years ago.
But we could bring them back.
We could probably.
We could find some remnants of a saber-toothed cat and clone it and recreate them.
That science is fascinating.
You know, they're talking about doing that.
Yeah, yeah. They want to do it with the mammoth.
Yeah. Mammoth, right.
So, we got off topic there.
Digression, excuse us.
But our natural fear response or our natural stress response to that is we got to get to safety because there could be something dangerous there.
Mm-hmm.
Again, the likelihood is that it's nothing, that it's the wind rustling the leaves.
Right.
But
you
what
don't
keeps
know.
Us alive right. is responding with stress and getting away and making sure you're safe.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a normal, natural, healthy thing to experience. And our brain keeps us safe for that reason. What we're talking about and what happens with these anxiety, this broad class of anxiety disorders, is our brain is responding in situations that it doesn't necessarily need to respond
to. Right.
Because mm-hmm. either the actual anxiety producer, the trigger, mm-hmm. is either unlikely to happen or it's... hyper-reactive.
Right.
Our brain is responding when it doesn't need to
mm-hmm.
because the fear isn't really there.
Or it's not likely going... For example, there are people who won't get on elevators.
Right.
Because when the doors close, the space becomes too small.
Right.
Nothing bad is going to happen to you in there. But there is this irrational fear of being in a small place.
Right.
We all hate being in small places. None of us want to be in a coffin. None of us want to be in, you know, rolled up in a carpet because we fear that we can't breathe.
Right.
Okay? But being in an elevator is not that small of a space and you can still breathe. Yet there is this irrational fear that your brain has to small spaces.
Right. And you're absolutely, you hit it spot on because... What happens, and again, this is there's some evolutionary importance to this,
right.
where we learn from experiences that we witness or that we hear about. And
right.
so, you know, a lot of times people will develop some of these anxieties because of something they hear. They hear about somebody being trapped in an elevator for 48 hours, or they hear about an elevator cable breaking and they fall and the people inside die.
40 stories to their death.
Right. Mm-hmm. Now, the likelihood of something like that ever happening again is very, very small.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, our brain interprets that as it happened once, it could happen again,
right.
and so I'm going to be anxious and nervous and worried about that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, thinking about how this works from an evolutionary perspective, you know, if you're out hunting and there's a rustling in the shrubs and the person that you're watching keeps walking, and the lion jumps out and attacks that person, you very quickly learn, okay, rustling in the brushes equals a lion jumping out and attacking you.
Right. It's a reasonable fear.
It's a reasonable fear.
Right.
But, you know, stepping on an elevator, you've never experienced anything negative happening on the elevator.
Right.
Yet, because of something that you heard that happened 1 in 100 billion times,
right,
you generalize that and say, well, it could happen this time.
Might.
And so... It's irrational, as you
That's
said.
That's the irrational part, right? That it might, yeah, it might happen, but not likely.
Right. I mean, I've met patients who have been fearful that, you know, satellites are going to fall on their house because, or something is going to fall out of an airplane and land on their house and hurt
right.
them because there was a story about something mm-hmm. falling out of an airplane. And
in Australia.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So we gain these irrational beliefs, and again, the basis of it is healthy. I mean, our brain
right.
wants to keep us safe.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is it becomes hypersensitive.
Right. In some people, it doesn't work the way it's supposed to work.
It, right.
Hypersensitive, I think, is a good word.
Yeah.
Hyperreactive.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So there are long term consequences of this, and we're again still talking about sort of general anxiety. That general class of anxiety. And there are some consequences to this. You know, when we are experiencing anxiety chronically, it takes a toll on our body.
Right.
We've all heard about elevations in blood pressure, increased heart rate. It suppresses our immune system. And again, all of that is biological.
Right.
When you are... Let's take a quick example. Let's say that you are using a similar example, but let's say you're walking in the woods and you hear something, and it's you hear a bear, and you begin to run. Well, your body turns on and off different systems to keep you safe.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're running from a bear, your body doesn't need to be digesting food.
Right.
Because it's saying, you know what, it's a little bit more important that we are running and getting to safety than it is to make sure that we're digesting the apple that we just ate.
Right.
So our digestive system turns off.
Mm-hmm.
We want to be fast. And so we increase adrenaline. We increase blood flow to our muscles so that mm-hmm. we can be faster. So certain systems turn on and off. Well, when we're in a chronic state of anxiety, a chronic state of stress, our body remains primed for those situations.
Mm-hmm.
Again, kind of getting more to the molecular level, our body isn't going to be worried about fighting an infection when
right.
we're running from a bear.
Right.
Because again, the acute stress is the bear, not any infection that we have.
Mm-hmm.
So it suppresses our immune system. Well, so it's not surprising that people who have chronic stress have a weakened immune system because their
right.
body's saying, we're in a state of stress. We don't need to necessarily worry about fighting any infections or doing anything like that. So our physical body, the way all kinds of systems in our body function, changes when we're in these chronic stress situations, chronic anxious conditions. So when we think about things like generalized anxiety disorder, we often see these individuals, and they have high blood pressure. They are very prone to getting sick, catching colds, getting the flu, and those kinds of things, because their physical body is being weakened by this chronic stress.
Right, right.
And this is all chemically based.
Right. The budget, the national budget for anxiety disorders, a third of our mental health budget goes for anxiety disorders because of these physical complaints.
Right.
And so there's a $42 billion a year is spent on anxiety disorders. And that's a third of the total mental health budget that our
yeah.
country has. And it's because people with anxiety disorders they go to the doctor more often, 5 times more likely, and they're 6 times more likely to be hospitalized. Precisely because of these physical symptoms.
Right. And there are some physical health conditions that are specifically related to anxiety. Ulcers, for example.
Ulcers, headaches.
Migraines, all those things.
Chronic pain.
We know that they are very strongly connected to anxiety. Mm-hmm. And so what we try to do in our practice and in mental health in general is we work to relieve that anxiety. And it shouldn't be surprising that when we relieve that anxiety and sometimes fix diet and those kinds of things, we see a vast improvement in those physical symptoms.
Right.
So there's lots of ramifications. There's lots of things associated with anxiety that we really need to recognize. But let's talk for a minute. I think, and this is a part that we were Richard, you and I were a little bit anxious about talking on, because it's the brain and what's happening in the brain with some of these conditions. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's important for us to talk about it. Because if you, listener, experience anxiety, I think it's crucial that you recognize that this is brain-based.
Right.
And that you can't just say, oh, don't worry about it. Because if you could not worry about it, you would not worry about it.
Right.
And so, you know, I've used the example already about walking in the woods and hearing a bear. What is fascinating about this, and, you know, Richard and I do a lot of work in neuropsychology and neuroscience, and our brain is a fascinating organ. The way that it does things and the functions of different regions of our brain that are, you know, we have these really important regions of our brain that if you just looked at the brain, you wouldn't necessarily even be able to differentiate those regions from any other regions, but yet they're critical. One region of our brain is called the thalamus, and it sort of sits right at the core of our brain, and it is, for lack of a better descriptor, it is Grand Central Station.
Right, it's the Atlanta airport.
Yes, everything comes through the thalamus, so all of your senses, except one, but all of your senses, all of the stimuli entering your body first goes to the thalamus. The only difference, the only one that doesn't is your smell, sense of smell, your olfactory. Mm-hmm. Your olfactory goes almost straight to...
Right to the brain.
Hardwired right into the cortex and your memory systems. And that's why our sense of smell actually is linked to our strongest memories.
That's right.
You can smell something and it immediately takes you back to some memory that you had or some...
Another digression.
Yeah.
This is the 10th anniversary of Katrina.
Right.
And they interviewed a woman this morning, and she said there's a Katrina smell. Uh-huh. And she said she'll go into her garage and get stuff out that was made moldy because of Katrina. And everybody will say, that's the Katrina smell. It has something to do with the mold.
Yeah.
And it's a powerful... Well, in most other species, olfaction drives reproduction.
Right.
Okay. It's an enormously powerful
pheromones.
Because of pheromones.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So say except for olfactory senses, everything else goes to the thalamus. And again, the thalamus is sort of this nice bulb right in the core of our brain. Now, while it is, you know, just simply a region inside of our brain, it's also, it almost functions like a micro brain, a mini brain. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what it does is it makes decisions. It makes decisions about where different stimuli go.
Right.
And so when you have visual stimuli, your thalamus says, oh, that's visual stimuli. Let's send it to the visual cortex.
Right.
Oh, this is auditory information. So let's send it to the auditory cortex and so on. It makes those decisions, if we want to call them decisions.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It recognizes the patterns and it recognizes the stimuli and it sends it off. And so disorders of the thalamus lead to different problems. And that's where people can smell colors.
Right.
And they can hear words or hear things that they see because the thalamus is kind of sending information to different places and it's creating a problem.
Right. Sends it to the wrong place.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which I think is fascinating, but we won't go on a digression there. How the thalamus is related to anxiety is another fascinating function. What the thalamus does is it receives information, and if it receives any stimuli that it sees as threatening or interprets as threatening to ourselves, it doesn't send it to the cortex first. It first sends that information to our limbic system.
Right.
And this is where we get into fight or flight. Mm-hmm. Actually, mm-hmm. It should be fight or flight or freeze.
Or freeze. There's three Fs. Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the thalamus makes that decision. So when you're walking in the woods, and I think this is fascinating. This is so exciting. So when you're walking in the woods...
You should be watching this from across the table.
It's exciting. Because when you're walking in the woods and you... when you hear that bear, you actually start running before you realize that it's a bear.
Before you know what it is. Before you identify it, you're on the move.
You're on the move. Now, this happened to my wife just the other night. There wasn't a bear, but we went for a walk. And as we're walking back, all of a sudden, she jumped over behind me and let out a little small scream. It wasn't significant.
Blood curdling.
But there was a snake, and she jumped and moved to safety behind me.
Behind.
You know.
Thank you. Yes.
But she moved and jumped to safety, and then afterwards she was like, "Ah, I hate it when it startles me like that," because she's not afraid of snakes. The snake's not. But her thalamus interpreted it as a threat, and she jumped over and moved to safety, even though she knew, you know. Seconds later, she recognized it was just a black racer. It wasn't anything dangerous. It was scurrying away, right. If snakes can scurry. It was getting away. So
there was more afraid of you than you
were
of it.
Right. There was no danger,
right.
But her thalamus interpreted as danger, and it forced her to behave before the information got to her cortex and she really realized what was going on.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. So our brain, our thalamus, in conjunction with our limbic system, makes us behave before we really recognize what's going on.
Right.
Everyone has experienced this. If you're in the backyard and you pick up something, you lift something out of your backyard, you jump back thinking that there's a snake or something there, and then afterwards you realize, oh, it's just the water hose, or it's just a lizard, or it's something benign, a rope or something. But you behave before you recognize what it is. Mm-hmm. And again, that's very evolutionarily important to keep us safe and to keep us secure. With these anxiety disorders, especially the stress-related disorders like PTSD and like adjustment disorders and things like that, our brain responds to those situations very sensitively. At times when it doesn't need to. Our thalamus interprets danger when it doesn't necessarily need to interpret danger.
But it doesn't want to take the chance of getting it wrong.
Right.
You know,
right.
That's the whole point.
It's being cautious.
Right. Right.
And it leads to problems for people, not when we can really recognize that stressor. It makes sense to me when people experience like PTSD, people who have been to war, you've been in a situation where you hear a gunshot and you look over and the person next to you has been hit. That it would make sense that your brain would say, hey, that sound is associated with something very bad. Where it's, you know, more confusing is when you have the person who has never been to war and never experienced anything negative, and they're walking through the grocery store and all of a sudden experience an intense panic attack.
Right. For no apparent reason.
Right. No triggers, no nothing going on. And those are the disorders, the panic disorders, panic attacks, that are much more difficult to manage because the thalamus is interpreting something as dangerous, but we don't know what it is.
We don't know what it is, right.
It is unrecognizable. Mm-hmm. And those anxiety conditions are really challenging to work with.
Right.
They're more difficult than social anxiety disorder because the identified stressor is there. They're more difficult than specific phobias. Okay, we know that you're afraid of snakes, so we know what to avoid, we know what to treat. But when you're talking about some of these panic disorders that come out of nowhere, those are really, really challenging and really confusing to people.
Right.
Because they don't know what to avoid.
If you don't know the trigger, you don't know what to avoid, you can't manage it.
Right.
It just happens.
But it is very much so brain-based.
Right.
It is in the brain. It's not just a person being unreasonable. It's not just a person being a worrywart. It is a real physiological behavior in the brain.
Right. An actual brain response.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so for those of you listening who experience panic attacks,
right,
because a lot of people experience panic attacks, mm-hmm. For those of you that experience that, know that it's not just you being unreasonable. So when people say, well, just don't worry about it, just get over it, and just, you know, when you're experiencing that panic attack, you need to just ignore it. We recognize that you can't do that. Mm-hmm. When the thalamus responds like that and it triggers the fight or flight response, remember earlier I was talking about how different parts of your body, different systems in your body respond to that. Your sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system responds to those things, and it makes you unable. You know, when a person freezes, they can't move. It is almost paralyzing. Mm-hmm. I think of the person who becomes almost combative. So they get into with the fight or freeze, they begin to fight.
Mm-hmm.
You know, our typical response to that is, okay, we're trying to get them to calm down.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what's happening in the brain and in the body during those times won't allow them to calm down.
Right.
You know, your body only has so much blood.
Right.
And so when you're fighting or you're running, you're flighting, if that's...
Fleeing.
I was trying to keep it with fight or flight. You're flighting. When you're trying to get away,
mm-hmm.
the important thing is getting away, not doing a math problem.
Right.
So blood is shunted from your cortex, which mm-hmm. makes the decisions and is a more reasonable part of your body. Blood is shunted from there, and it goes to your muscles to make you faster. It helps moms lift cars off babies and things mm-hmm. like that. It makes you stronger and faster. There's no blood
in your brain right.
during those times. And so you can't make decisions.
Mm-hmm.
So no matter if a person is experiencing a panic attack, it is useless to say, okay, take a deep breath. Mm-hmm. Okay, calm down. Right. Because they're not interpreting that as a healthy stimulus.
Right.
So we have to take a different approach in those kinds of situations.
Mm-hmm.
So... That that is what's happening, especially with the stress category or the panic category of our anxiety disorders. We have to deal with that stress from the perspective of more preventative. You know, what can we do to decrease the exposure to that stressor? And again, that's what makes it difficult when there is no identifiable stressor. Those are probably the most challenging mm-hmm. anxiety patients to work with.
Right. Yeah, they really are. When I think of all the people I've dealt with, when you don't have a specific trigger, it makes it enormously difficult to deal with, mainly for the person who's experiencing the panic
right.
attack, because they don't know where it's coming from.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So I think it's important to stress that again, the brain is doing what it's designed to do, but it's doing it at the wrong time.
Right.
Or when it doesn't need to do it. But it is very difficult to deal with if you don't know the triggers.
Right, mm-hmm. right. So let's talk, Richard, a little bit about what do we do about these? Let's talk about treatment a little bit. Do we have anything else on our list?
I want to do that before we talk about the obsessive compulsive.
Oh, that's right. I skipped right over that, didn't I?
Yeah.
The OCD mm-hmm. group.
That's your third category, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
So what we have with the obsessive group is we have developed a system, sometimes maladaptively. With OCD, what the patient has done is they've developed a system to cope with the anxiety, right. with the stress response.
This is what the movie was about with Jack Nicholson.
Right. As Good as It Gets.
As Good as It Gets.
Right.
He had developed ritualized behaviors to deal with his obsessions.
Right. So let's differentiate obsessions and compulsions.
Right.
Obsessions are thoughts. They are right. Beliefs or they are views. And oftentimes, obsessions would fall into the category of anxiety, the anticipatory.
Yeah. Right.
So it falls into the category of these are worries. These are stresses that they experience that mm-hmm. sometimes become impairing. So it's, I'm anxious about touching something because I could get germs that will make me sick. Or I'm anxious about being in an airplane because the airplane could crash. And so the person has these anxieties. And where it kind of shifts into this third category is when they begin to develop compulsive behaviors to accommodate for those obsessive anxieties.
So your obsession, say you have an obsession about germs.
Right.
Okay. Then you do hand washing, right. repeated hand washing to deal with that obsession.
Right.
Okay.
So you're, yeah, that's, and that was an example that was in the movie As Good As It Gets with Jack Nicholson.
And he used scalding hot water.
He used scalding hot water, and he had to use a new bar of soap each time because the germs from the first time washing could get on, and he'd have to do it three times. And so he would use the very hot water, a new bar of soap. And if you remember when he opened his medicine cabinet, there's just all, it's just full of bars of soap. And that is what happens when we kind of enter into this third category of, again, I kind of refer to it as preventative. So what we've developed is maladaptive ways to prevent or cope with the anxiety.
Right. You're sort of treating it yourself.
Right.
But in a maladaptive way.
Right.
That doesn't make it better.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I think this is an important place to say that all compulsive behaviors is not true. Impairing.
Right.
You know, I think about it in, I don't watch baseball all that often.
Too
I watch
slow.
Soccer.
Too slow for your soccer.
It's too slow. But with baseball, if you watch a batter getting up to bat, right. many batters, not all batters, but many batters do exactly the same thing every time they get up to
right.
bat.
Right.
There are a few that have very extravagant compulsive behavior. So they touch certain things. They restrap their batting gloves. They tap different things. They do different things. And, you know, it's fascinating as a study of human behavior. It's fascinating to watch because, right. you know, they go through this 30-second routine. They get up there, and then the pitcher throws the ball to first base to try to pick off the runner. And then they step out, and they go through the whole thing
again.
It's like, right. you didn't even do anything.
Did you? Never mind. We'll talk about it. The baseball commissioner had to put an end to that stuff. Because it was making the game too long.
Yeah.
Because a batter would step out of the batter's box every time, redo his gloves, adjust his helmet, step back in. And that was adding too much time to the game. The games were getting too long.
Yeah.
So the commissioner had to say, no more of that stuff. You have to be in the batter's box in a certain amount of time.
Wow. That's
to
great.
Deal with those ritualized behaviors.
Right. And those ritualized behaviors are there because the batter feels for some reason that the last time it felt like this or I did this, right. I was able to get on base or I made a good hit or something like that.
Right.
And so they do that repeatedly to increase mentally their ability to get on base.
Especially baseball players.
Yeah.
They're notorious for these superstitions that they have.
Right.
About clothes and not washing their socks and, you know, going through these motions that will guarantee success.
Right, right. And we see it in football some, especially with quarterbacks. I was watching one football game not long ago. It was a repeat. You know, it was a quarterback who he always licks his fingers before he goes up. And it was cold, so we had a gloves on. And he's licking the gloves. It's like, why are you licking the gloves? You don't have to lick the glove to get better grip. But it was just a routine behavior that he did each time. So,
But those aren't impairing.
Those aren't impairing.
I mean, he can still play the game and throw the pass. And so he's doing that, but it's not hurting anybody. It's
right.
not impairing him in any way.
Right. Okay. And it goes along with the people who wear their sports jerseys on the days that their team plays and those kinds of things. Those are ritualized or compulsive types of behaviors, but they're not impairing.
Right.
When it becomes impairing, like we saw with Jack Nicholson in the movie and with other people with OCD, those ritualized behaviors become impairing because the key part that we see in the DSM diagnostically is it consumes a significant amount of time.
Right.
And that's when it becomes a problem.
And that movie, that his obsessive compulsive behavior, didn't it ultimately damage the relationship that he was going to have with the woman?
Multiple relationships, yeah.
Right. And that's what we mean by it impairs your functional abilities. He was not able to have a relationship. Wasn't it Helen Hunt? Didn't
yes,
she play
yes, she was
the lead? And he couldn't have a relationship with her because of his OCD.
Right.
That's an impairment.
Right.
Right.
And there was a great episode on, I'm a big fan of Scrubs, the TV show. There was a great few episodes with Michael J. Fox. And Michael J. Fox played a...
Recently?
No, this was years ago. Michael J. Fox played a character, a physician character, who had serious, severe OCD. Mm-hmm. And what was really, you know, they did such a great job in that program for a lot of reasons, but they showed how his OCD was helpful to him in some cases, as a medical and doctor and surgeon, it showed that he was very obsessive about reading and rereading his books and making sure that he knew everything and that he expected the worst, and so that helped him remain calm and things like that. But it also showed the detriment to it, where, you know, he finishes a surgery and 3 hours later he's still washing his hands after the surgery, and he wants to go home, but he can't go home because it doesn't feel right. He still feels like he has to wash his hands. Right. So that's when it becomes impairing, when it starts taking up a considerable amount of time. It interferes with relationships. It interferes with other functioning that you have to have to do.
And that's what makes it a disorder.
Right,
rather than just a superstition.
Right. Okay. So that third category, again, we kind of refer to it as preventative, because that's when the person is using these maladaptive strategies to cope with the anxious feelings, the obsessive thoughts. And the important thing with obsessive thoughts is that they can be about anything. The common ones, of course, are germs and safety and those kinds of things, turning on and off the lights multiple times, locking and unlocking the door multiple times. But it can be about a lot of different things. I had a patient once whose obsessive thoughts were more sexual in nature, and a teenage boy, and he couldn't stop thinking about it. Now, there is some normalcy to that, because teenage boys think about those things a lot, but it was impairing his functioning because he couldn't not think about it until he did something to deal with it. And what he had to do to deal with it was to talk about it. He had to express his thoughts to somebody, sort of as a dump to just get it out. Mm-hmm. And then once he was able to get it out, then he was able to stop thinking about it. But he couldn't stop until he talked about it. Right. And clearly that's a problem at school, because those are things you can't talk about to just anyone at school. Right. And it created other issues. So the obsessions can be about most anything. But the key part to it is that, you know, what the people experience is that even when they want to stop thinking about it, they can't.
Right.
That's sort of one of the hallmark features of obsessions. And again, then they develop these compulsive behaviors to deal with it. And that's impairing.
Right. Yeah, the obsession itself is not just the compulsive behavior. The obsession itself is in control.
Right.
I mean, we don't have control over it. It has control over us.
Right. 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 Mm-hmm. So with these three groups, we have the anticipatory group, the panic group, and then the preventative maladaptive coping group. Mm-hmm. Our treatment is different for the different ones. And we're at 53 minutes now or so. Once we add the intro and all that kind of stuff, it's going to be a little bit later. So maybe we need to talk about treatment next time. What do you think?
Yeah. Let's do that. I think treatment is a separate topic, because there are some new treatments that we want to talk about. The typical ones are medication and psychotherapy, but there are some new treatments I think that we ought to be discussing in this forum.
Okay. Right, right. Yeah. So the big thing that we hope listeners are able to gain from today's podcast is, one, that anxiety is a normal function.
Anxiety is normal.
And anxiety and stress are things that we need. And let's maybe just refer to it as stress. Stress is something that we need to function in a healthy, productive way. Mm-hmm. As it becomes impairing and it starts interfering with our functioning, that's when we start to get into the anxiety disorders. And again, we have those three categories of anticipatory anxiety, panic types of anxiety, and then the preventative or poor coping strategy anxieties. And as we get into next week, our treatment for them is going to be very different. Sometimes medication is really important. Anxiety disorders need to be treated sometimes with medication. Right. The medication is going to vary depending on what the presentation is.
Right.
And in fact, despite what some physicians do, sometimes medication is counterproductive.
Right.
Sometimes we want to avoid using medications for certain things. Mm-hmm. So we'll get into that. But again, it's all brain-based.
Right.
It's your brain responding in the way that it's supposed to, mm-hmm. but at times when it's not appropriate.
That's right. And the medications target those brain areas that are not working properly.
Right.
That's what it's designed to do.
Right.
Okay.
So that's what's supposed to happen. Right. So, all right. So now we have our topic for next time.
Yeah, that would be good.
Yeah, it's because there's a lot of things to talk about with mm-hmm. treatments.
Right.
So we'll leave it with that. If you're listening to this podcast and you have any positive or negative
thoughts,
we would love to hear from you. Please feel free to send us an email or message us on our blog at thementalbreakdown.com. You can follow us on Twitter at Dr. Bernie, or you can follow us on Facebook. We have we have several Facebook pages. Mm-hmm. Everything that we post goes to all of those different sources, so give us a follow and see what you think, and send us some messages and let us know. If there's any particular topics that you would like to hear us talk about, like for us to discuss, would love for you to go on to iTunes and write us a message. We got a new review this past week, which was a great review. So thank you very much. But
We'd love to hear from you. Let us know how we're doing. If you like us, tell everybody else. If you don't like us, tell us.
Yeah.
But we'd love to hear from you.
Yeah. Definitely write into us and let us know your thoughts. And keep an eye out for our newsletter. It should be coming out soon. You'll be able to get that at our website at pacflorida.com. pacflorida.com. Mm-hmm.
Check the dates for those workshops.
Those workshops are going
to
be...
Love to see you there.
Yes. Okay. We're finding locations that we can have them that will be great locations and great venues for lots of people to be able to make it and to have a good discussions. So,
plenty of room and good snacks.
Good snacks. And beverages. Healthy snacks.
Right. Healthy snacks and beverages.
Yes. So, until next time, I'm Dr. Bernie.
And I'm Dr. Richard.
Have a great week, and we will see you next time. Or talk to you next time. I guess we won't see them, will we?
No, we see each other.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to The Mental Breakdown. If you want more information, you can check out our website at www.pacflorida.com. The Mental Breakdown is sponsored in part by theledger.com, where you can read our weekly column in the Life section. Our podcasts are available for download on iTunes, and you can follow us on our YouTube channel and Facebook. We would love to hear from you, so feel free to send us messages either through our website or on Facebook. You can send us questions or topics you would like for us to address on future podcasts. Drs. Bernie and Richard are available for workshops, so you can contact us for more information. Thank you for listening, and until next time, stay mentally healthy.